25 years ago, a small press was a mimeograph machine cranked by disaffected artists and political activists. Distribution tended to be leafleting street corners and small cafes. But it was a movement. In 1992, a small press is likely to have offices, staff, and perhaps international connections. But it's also a movement. I'm Susan McGinnis, this is Conversations, and today we'll be talking about small press and small presses with Jennifer Moyer, who is a publisher, editor, and a poet. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
I want to ask you this question about the transition of small presses. Do you think the transition happened as a natural evolution over time from mimeograph machine to offices and international connections, or did a decade affected in a major way? And I'm thinking about the 80s when multinationals kind of came along and gobbled up major publishers in the United States.
A combination, probably. Yeah. Part of it's that we grew up, I mean, I was doing mimeograph in the 70s, and now I'm doing an office and fax machines. So part of it's coming into our own middle age, I think. Mm-hmm. The other part certainly is that times change and printing technologies change and politicians change, and they all affect us and we have to respond to them. And the one probably notable thing about small press is that it never stands still. So if it's going to be mimeograph one year, it's going to be something else mm-hmm. the next, and quite deliberately so, even though maybe not consciously an effort. It does respond to what's around it and reacts to it. The one thing that it tries to do, I think, is always step outside of the mainstream so that it can keep a kind of consciousness and a national literature alive that the mainstream may be ignoring.
So whatever the mainstream is doing lets you know directly and indirectly what to do.
In part, I'd like to think that we pride ourselves in also initiating and creating some movements rather than just reacting to what the mainstream is doing. Mm-hmm. But certainly, fringe groups have always been as a result of what the mainstream is doing, and we're a fringe group.
Right.
So we are reacting.
Give me a definition of small press. It can't be just one thing, a gathering of a number of kinds of movements, thoughts, presses?
Yes.
And?
Anything you want it to be. I have hesitated to make a definitive description of small press mm-hmm. because I'd rather leave the doors open than shut the doors on what it means. But I think in its essence, it really means any publisher who is an independent and can be publishing one book a year, have published one book in their lifetime, and they would be a small press. They may be publishing 15 or 20 titles like I'm doing at my own publishing house. That's a small press. It may be even someone the size of the now defunct North Point that was doing 50 titles a year.
Right.
It's more a mental state, although it's certainly a physical state too.
Mental state. We're not talking bigger or smaller than a bread box. We're talking about how you approach publishing.
Absolutely. The intent.
Right.
You know, our intention. And our intention is publishing something that we see as important or needed or something that we're committed to, or all of those things.
There is a politic to small presses, then?
There is. If sometimes it's stated and sometimes it's assumed. I wouldn't say that the man who publishes books on railroad lanterns of the 19th century intends to be outside of the mainstream, but he obviously is. And he does quite well for himself. Uh-huh. There's a huge market for that.
He's a niche publisher, is
niche
that right?
Niche publisher.
Okay. These are the ones I know. University?
Definitely.
Okay. Regional?
Regional presses who are publishing sometimes in the tens of thousands of copies of books that are only appeal to, say, Central Alaska. But they know their market. They know that something's needed, like a bed and breakfast guide to Fairbanks, where there are 160 bed and breakfast or something like that.
Right.
And that would sell quite well.
Okay.
And they know it. They can reach the market. But from Mount Kisco, New York, I certainly can't. So I can't do that.
Okay.
There are intellectual niches too. There are lesbian mysteries, and quite odd, and do quite well. Uh-huh. There is a lot of lesbian fiction and a lot of lesbian nonfiction, which has been pioneered by small presses and now picked up by the mainstream publishers, because once, this is another thing that small presses do, but once they see something that's needed and develop a market for it, sometimes the big guys come and cash in on it.
And is that good, bad, and ugly all at once for your...
Some people think it's good, some people think it's bad. I mean, the bad part is sometimes authors are taken away from the small presses who nurture them.
Right.
And that feels unfair. The good thing, of course, is, I mean, our whole point as publishers is to get the word out and promote our authors. And if it means a large publisher can do that better than me, then the author should go there and
That's
have
right.
my blessing. So that is my role. So I shouldn't resent it when it works.
This is Jennifer Moyer on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Jennifer Moyer is a poet, as I mentioned early on. Two books to her credit, published in 1981 and 1987, respectively, by Spoon River Poetry Press. The first was Frontier Woman's Scrapbook, and the second, Traveling with Coyotes. Jennifer, with her husband, Britt Bell, own Moyer Bell Limited, recently and currently, although barely, of Mount Kiska, New York, and soon to be of Wakefield, Rhode Island. They're exchanging good cross-country skiing territory for excellent ocean territory, but still staying within the loop of New York publishers. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Jennifer, you are here. I'm telling the audience more than I am telling you, of course, as a participant in the Midnight Sun Writers Conference, mm-hmm. the 12th annual conference to happen here at the university, brought to us by the English Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. You said in a craft talk the other night, you gave us a quote by Ezra Pound, and I want to know from you why you're bringing this up at this time. What you said was, if a nation's literature declines, the nation atrophies and decays. What about the 90s, the end of the 20th century, has you resurrecting Pound?
Because I worry about the limitations and the specialties that are forcing us all into one way of looking at things, and small ways of looking at things, and television and visual things taking over where we used to have words. We don't read as much as a nation. I mean, there's some talk that even newspapers are going to be obsolete, but you can't think without words. It's impossible for me to think of having a culture without having a written culture. So I think it's in danger. I think we endanger ourselves when we have a homogeneous publishing industry, large publishing industry, when we have a nation that does not respect the written word or the writer who writes it, and certainly doesn't help promote them or preserve them. And we have a nation of readers who don't read much and don't care much, and really do not have the sense that the power of the word is an all-consuming power. And that, I think, is the most worrisome part of the era we live in.
What does that do to us, in your mind? What's the worst possible consequence of people putting down books and newspapers and picking up television, computer screens?
Well, it really separates us. We don't communicate with each other. We don't grow as a human species. I mean, we don't ever test the limits of what we can do, who we are, where we're going, why we're here. None of that goes on, I don't think, when you sit in front of the boob tube and become a vidiot. It doesn't happen. And when it doesn't happen, then we atrophy as individuals, and then that spreads out into a community, into a nation. And I think, you know, part of our failing as a nation in the last 10 or 15 years is partly because we haven't been on the cutting intellectual edge.
People attack us as not raising children who are adept in math and science. It's not just math and science.
That's one thing that we certainly need, but we need more than that. We've had a huge push in the last generation or two, and a great deal of respect and energy that is focused on the sciences, with, you know, amazing results. I mean, you can see it in all of the activity up here in Alaska, and the science and geology and the weather forecasting and all of the stuff that's going on up here is as a result of our you know, our respect of that whole era of thinking. And my worry is that if we leave words behind, we will just eventually all shut up and not speak to each other, much less write to each other.
You have accused the big houses of committing a failure, of having failed literature in America. How'd they do that?
They did it by bottom-lining themselves, yeah. I think. They are resting on their reputations, some of which are very good, that they have developed from having published literature, but they have left it behind because it's not economically, doesn't contribute to the bottom line. They have become so big they can't afford to do it anymore, or they think they can't afford to do it anymore. And they have, through no fault of their own, been bought up by conglomerates that don't really care about what they're doing and tried to impose the same kinds of business restrictions that run, you know, that run hosiery-making companies, and you can't do it. Book publishing is, in major part, intuition. You don't pick up a book and decide, like you do with something like perfume, that you, if you spend $6 million, you'll have a success. If you spend $200,000, you'll flop. It doesn't work that way. Sometimes a book runs away for no reason that anyone can ever figure out. And with the exception of a few mass market titles, which you can create a market for something that is going to be mass produced and appeal to the masses, but in general, a real book.
Stephen King,
well, I mean, he now doesn't need to be marketed. He has a market.
Right.
But you can pick up whatever the fad of the moment may be and publish a book and push it out there and buy enough co-op space and bookstores and put enough ads and convince people that this is the book they need. And if you're lucky, you might be able to get it on the bestseller list. But for real books, books of literature, books of serious nonfiction, poetry, you can't make the market. And you should only publish what is the best that you can find, the best of our American literature. Mm-hmm. And the big guys are not doing that so much anymore because they can't. A book that sells 2,000 copies not only doesn't contribute to the bottom line, it takes away from it. And they think they can't afford to do it.
Because the amount of energy you have to put in for the amount you get back.
Yes, and right. The unit cost of publishing, printing 2,000 copies, the unit cost goes way up. If you print 20,000, it goes way down. Mm-hmm. So if you keep on a book that only sells 2,000 copies, it's suicide to them. Now, the smaller presses run leaner. We work out of our houses, out of our basements, out of begged, borrowed, and stolen property, and we can do things cheaper. We don't have an enormous staff and a Manhattan rent to pay for. We have small staffs and can actually make money selling 2,000 copies of a book. So we can not only afford to do it, we have a commitment to doing it.
Don't you also have to deal with the bottom line?
Yep.
So you don't go under?
Yep.
I mean, something happened to North Point Press, even though it was the biggest small press in the nation and the most solid.
They overspent. They made an error that some of us make. I mean, that the big guys make as well as the small guys. The big guys can just hide it more because they have more money. And a small independent house like mine, where I publish 15 books, if I make a big mistake on one of them, it's going to show up. If you publish 1,500 books and make a mistake on one, doesn't matter. Okay. North Point's problems were kind of an exaggerated problem of what we all have, which is if we overspend and beautifully produce books and expect a market to be there for books because of the way they look, then we'll fail miserably. And when you lose money every year for 10 years, you can't keep it up. So obviously, independents have to make money just like everyone else, or we won't stay in business.
And do you look for a winner to help you float the books that you feel must be kept on shelves for the good of the democracy?
Cautiously, because a bestseller could land you in the bankruptcy courts. Because if you, yes, I know it's hard to imagine, and this is where people think I'm nuts, but if you, let's say you take a big book and it runs away with you and you print 50,000 copies and get 48,000 of them out there, the chains often return 50%, 60% of those. Oh. And if you've printed 50,000 and get 25,000 of them back, you most often won't make much money from it.
Your lean, mean condition will collapse.
It will collapse. Weight, right? It will. I mean, first of all, coming up with the money to print that many is a problem.
Give us a more than a hint about the logistics of bookstores and books in bookstores. They don't stay there long, right?
No, and it's another problem with, I think, having books out there at all. There are 50,000 books published a year. Bookstores, if in carry an inventory of, say, 10,000 or 50,000. I mean, when you consider all the books in print, there are more than a million. How is a bookstore going to stock them all? They're not. And a bookstore works on a small margin, just like publishers do, so they have the same problems we do. So they can't afford to keep books on the shelves, and often the average life of a front list or a new title is 6 weeks in a bookstore. And if it doesn't sell, out it goes. And sometimes, if it does sell, a bookstore won't reorder. They'll say, well, I got my money, I sold my books, and I'm going to go home and be happy. So it's a problem that, of course, publishers, large and small, will complain about. But bookstores are our lifeblood, and we don't complain too loudly.
And are there bookstore chains like publishing house conglomerates which focus on the bottom line, and then like small presses, are there also small hometown bookstores who would defend their titles to the end and
yes.
put their readers first? Is
yes.
that whole spectrum in there?
There is, and it sounds very exaggerated to say the chains focus on bottom lines and the independent bookstores focus on quality, but it's almost that simple. I mean, obviously there are now some super stores at both Walden's and Dalton's, which is now owned by Barnes & Noble, have opened, which are fantastic stores. They have huge inventory and a wide range. I don't know if they'll make it, but I hope they do. Independent bookstores are much more committed to the reader, ergo they're much more committed to independent publishers, because independents bring a whole breadth of literature into their store that the conglomerates aren't doing. So in order to have a full-spectrum bookstore, you have to have a combination of big guys and small guys.
Always walking on a tightrope, I would guess.
They are.
Yeah.
Because if they move into a neighborhood with a chain that discounts their bestsellers and they're selling them for full cover price, it's hurting them. And the independents are suffering from it. Mm-hmm. So I'm a champion of the independents because they're fighting the good fight.
Jennifer Moyer is with us today from Moyer Bell Limited. She and her husband co-own this company, our joint publishers. Moyer Bell every year puts out art books, resource books, scholarly nonfiction, fiction, and poetry. You said 15 titles a year, about?
That's about right.
How many titles total? 100 or so? Is that right?
I have about 85 on the backlist now.
Jennifer Moyer from Moyer Bell Limited, also the publisher and editor of Small Press Magazine, a magazine that caters to the needs and interests of small presses around the nation. There are about 28,000, Ms. Moyer says, small presses that we, quote, know about, and many more, we assume, mimeograph machines plugging away out there. You were a member of the Literary Arts Panel of the National Endowment for the Arts, the panel which walked when asked to put in or respect a decency code. I want to know why you walk. What's the problem with decency?
Nothing, of course. The problem is when the Congress of the United States writes into the reauthorization bill of the National Endowment that grants must be made based on general standards of decency. In my book, the Congress is not upholding the Constitution of the United States, which preserves our right, our freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And it seems to me that the Congress should be first on line to do that and not first on line to compromise that. They're imposing a limitation, a creative artistic limitation on the National Endowment for the Arts means that the National Endowment, unlike state arts agencies or private foundations funding the arts, has to impose a decency, whatever that means, clause on every one of their decisions to fund artists and writers. And our beef was really not with the National Endowment. I mean, the National Endowment was up until Congress rewrote their language, was giving grants based strictly on artistic merit. Now they give grants based on artistic merit if they're not indecent, whatever that means. And our protest was against Congress restricting the National Endowment. We didn't want to have anything to do with it.
What's your, given your point of view, what's your level of optimism for the nation? Is this a phase we're in where we are narrowing our view of what is decent, narrowing our view of what we will allow under the First Amendment, and it will move out again?
I don't have a crystal ball, but things tend to go in phases. And I suppose hope springs eternal, and otherwise we'd slit our wrists. But I think this is a phase. I think that the whole 80s and the kind of selfish, is your life better today than it was yesterday, rather than the 60s, you know, what can, ask not what, you know, your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I hope that that will come back around, and I think it will. I think we'll move out of this, we'll become conscious of what it's done, this insular and individual attitude has done to us as a whole, as a nation, as a community of people, and it will change. I think that we have to always, and if you look at history, you'll see that if you don't constantly protest and scream and yell when someone tries to take away the least little liberty, then you get into trouble. Then if they can get away with one thing, they'll get away with another. And we only have ourselves to blame if they do.
Around the area of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, are there exercised freedoms that make you nervous? If we look at it from a religious fundamentalist's point of view, sexual issues make them very nervous. Civil libertarians can be made very nervous by the Ku Klux Klan or skinheads or new Nazi movement exercising their freedom of speech. How about for Jennifer Moyer? And what do you do when you get distressed, if you do?
They don't make me nervous, but other things make me nervous. They just make me mad. But I think if you're going to assume the position that speech is protected, then you have to assume the position that speech, your speech, even if it offends me, even if it's hate speech, even if it's religious rightism or leftism, whatever, I have to allow you to your freedom of speech as well. Otherwise, I won't be allowed my freedom of speech. So I think we have to get beyond it. We're always going to be offended or made nervous or dislike or even hate some things that some people are going to say. There's no way you can live in a community of people and not have that happen.
Well, what about that fear that if you let those people talk, and whatever that means, given context, that they're going to take over our life for the rest of us?
Well, then we have to talk back and use our powers of persuasion. It brings me back to what this independent press movement is. I think that we're talking back to the mainstream, to homogeneity, to, you know, the status quo, and saying that's not all there is. It's not that those are the bad guys. It's just that that's only part of it, mm-hmm. and there's a whole other part of it out here. And if we don't, you know, speak up, no one will, and it won't occur to people that there's something else out there. So that's our responsibility. And, you know, you wake up or you are born, and either you're on that side or this side. It's not that we're antagonistic, although we sometimes become that way, but we don't have to be that way. But it's just that there are many points of view, and we have to make sure that they all have room to speak.
Do you think that a democracy is of necessity an optimistic place to live?
Optimistic? Never thought of it in that term, but it certainly is, because it allows for individual kinds of not only expression, but, you know, quirky kinds of behavior, and it protects, it really does protect individuals' right to do a lot of things, sometimes at the expense of the majority. I mean, maybe physical expense, but because of it, I think our hope is in individuals. Mm-hmm. I think. Not everyone agrees with me.
Jennifer Moyer is with us. I mentioned that she is the publisher and editor-in-chief of a... Are you still the editor-in-chief?
Actually, I'm the publisher.
Now publisher.
Don't, my editor-in-chief would never like to hear you say that I'm editor-in-chief of that magazine.
We'll hope she or he never hear. It's a magazine that's been around since 1983. Moyer Bell bought it in 1991, expanded it, more pages, more sections, more articles, all for people who own, run, participate in small presses in the United States. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations on KUAC. I want to go back to the NEA for a minute and kind of stay in this same realm of freedom of speech in a democracy. Many people argue that the state should not be participating in the funding of the arts, whether we're talking about literature or art or dance, doesn't matter. That this is something that should come from the people, be supported by the people, and kind of live and die, rise or fall, on the people's dime. Where do you stand on that? You sat with the NEA.
But the people now in contemporary 1992 are made up of different things. The people can be an individual patron of the arts. The people can be the stockholders of a corporation. The people can be the people who vote for the law, the very few laws that govern what foundations do, who fund artistic efforts. And the people can be the people who vote the government that, you know, governs us.
Okay.
So the people is made up of many different things. And individual patrons will shy away from some kind of art. Corporations will never touch some of the more controversial art.
Doesn't go with cornflakes.
Doesn't go with cornflakes. Stockbrokers don't usually like it. Foundations have a little more freedom. So they'll often be the ones, but they're usually cumbersome. And they're usually made up of panels or governing boards that tend to be more conservative. Not always. There are some foundations that are doing some really gutsy things. The Mellon Foundation, since its complete revamping, has come out of the dark ages and is taking incredible risks. The MacArthur Foundation in Chicago is putting themselves on the map, taking all kinds of risks. But in general, they tend to be a little more conservative. Mm-hmm. That leaves what? The government. And odd as it may seem, the government has been the place where we have protected some artists' right to do some gutsy, unusual, cutting-edge, avant-garde things. And I think it's because, for one, they're unfettered. They don't have stockbrokers. They don't have some rich person's pocketbook to answer to. They don't have a foundation board to have to worry about pleasing. They are simply given the responsibility of making decisions or making recommendations based on artistic merit. Now, that is a lot of freedom. And it was as a result of it, you're going to find things funded there that no one else would touch, like the Mapplethorpe exhibit. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you're going to find some things that not everyone agrees with because it's not conservative.
should governments get scared to death by warring factions, let's say, over the Mapplethorpe exhibit? Is that just part of this process? The government, via what it funds, steps out there, takes a risk, somebody slaps back? Is this part of the process of determining what we will support and what we won't?
It shouldn't determine what we will support and what we won't. It's always been a concern. And the National Endowment for the Arts and other state agencies who've gotten involved in the arts have always had to go to the mat to protect and defend some of the decisions they made and and the grants they make. But we shouldn't worry us. It just shouldn't fluster us either. We shouldn't stop and think, oh, you know, maybe they are right, and maybe we should just move a little bit from here to there, and then we'll avoid all that criticism over there. Mm-hmm. No, we shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Either we believe in the Constitution or we don't. It's as simple as that. And all it takes is someone gutsy to stand up to Congress or to a local state legislature and say, I'm sorry that we offended you, but we have a role here, and our role here is to fund the highest, the best, the most creative, the most artistic, the highest quality art that is going on in this state or this nation. And we summon together panels of the most artistic and biggest experts in any given area that we can find, and they make decisions, and we go along with them, even if sometimes we don't agree and don't like them.
Would you go back to the NEA if invited? I assume it's
an
invited position.
I have actually been invited and declined until Congress removes their compromising language, because I feel like, I mean, certainly I've taken the stand, I'm not going to go back, but also I'll be paid to do, or I'll be invited to sit on a panel to compromise American arts, and to me that is anathema, mm-hmm. So I won't. And I am sorry about it, but I don't think there's any other stand one can take. The sculpture panel just did the same thing this year for the same reason. And the National Endowment for the Arts is up for reauthorization this fall, and it'll be interesting to see what Congress does in an election year, which is different from 2 years ago when they imposed a compromising language.
Choose one of the following. The First Amendment is alive and well in America today. Censorship is alive and well in America today. Yes, no?
How can I choose? They're
both?
It's both true.
Show me censorship. Can you reach out and point? The decency standards, I assume you would
That's
say.
That's certainly censorship. Yeah. There's also censorship any time an individual on his or her own or encouraged by a, you know, bona fide religious group goes into a library and tells the librarian to take something off her shelves. That's an attempt at censorship. There's all kinds of censorship going on that is nothing like this was discussed in the writers' conference up here at the university. Certainly nothing like what's been going on in Eastern Europe. So there are relative degrees. But my feeling has always been if you let them, you know, a little chink in, then, you know, they have a little stronghold, and it can only get larger. So you have to be vigilant and always fight against it, always fight against any attempts at censorship of whatever kind, the kind you like, the kind you agree with, the kind you don't agree with.
What kinds of censorship don't we much notice? I guess I'm asking you if this is an insidious thing that kind of slides up around our heels without us seeing that it's there.
Well, we don't. Most people applaud when they see a peep show pornographic bookstore taken off the main street in town.
Mm-hmm. Andrea Dworkin against pornography.
Right.
It's the righteous thing to do.
It is a righteous thing to do. I have to say I disagree with her. Mm-hmm. That I think that the Supreme Court ruling on obscenity is a pretty good one. And if something has no artistic, cultural, or social redeeming value, then it does seem to me to be obscene. But if it does have one of those values, then it's not. And even if, as a feminist, I don't know of any woman who endorses pornography, but I do endorse the right of writers and artists and filmmakers and every other creative person to use all kinds of, you know, sexual images and other sexuality in their art.
Okay. Now, what do you say to the people who say to you, or, yes, what do you say to the people who say to you, but the society is falling apart, it's in moral decay, my children are at risk, my wife is at risk, my husband is at risk by what's going on, we have to draw the line somewhere. Keep ourselves safe. Get that book out of my library.
We have to do it in other ways. You cannot give up your principles because it's practical to do so. You have to find, there are other ways of protecting family values or protecting women in society. And I think we have to do that. We cannot, then we become a Cuba, where they say everything within the revolution is possible, everything outside of the revolution is not possible. And they mean that if you are part of the party and go along with the party line, we'll give you a car and we'll let you write and we'll publish your books. But if you don't, we won't. And what kind of freedom is that? Mm-hmm. So they have full employment and school education, but they don't have the right to say what they want. We do take care of the, you know, so they take care of the essential clothing and feeding people, but where are you? So it's difficult to say that, and it means we have to be very creative about protecting women in society, for instance. Not a popular feminist stand.
I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations, and today we're talking with Jennifer Moyer. We talked a moment ago about Jennifer Moyer's past membership on the NEA Literary Arts Panel. She has also been on the board of directors of the Associated Writing Programs in this nation. That's an organization of writers and teachers supporting the development of writers and writing in and out of the academy, and a director for the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, assisting any artist that needs any kind of legal help, a non-lawyer director. What's your response to books like American Psycho, the first publisher, I guess, that optioned it, ran away, got frightened because it was such a violent book. Someone eventually, it was either Knopf or Simon & Schuster, mm-hmm. put it out. Bookstores quailed before the jacket of this book. Satanic Verses, for different reasons, got the same response. Publishers were frightened of it. Book dealers were frightened of it because the Khomeini said he would cause to be damaged anyone who touched this book. In a democracy, do we have a responsibility to kind of tighten our belts, gird our loins, and march forward no matter how frightening this particular representation of the freedom of speech is?
I would have had two different reactions to those two books if I were a bookstore owner.
Let me know.
For American Psycho, I would have stocked it. As repugnant as it is, and as much as I would have voiced an opinion against it and never read it, I would have stocked it for the, you know, for the very reasons we've been talking about, because it has a right to exist, even as repulsive as it is. The Ayatollah's threats, and actually there are several translators who have been killed in this whole problem, and having been to the last couple of Frankfurt International Book Fairs, rights fairs, and watch the Viking booths and the Viking staffs having to be surrounded by armed guards at all times is a slightly different problem. And even our legal system recognizes that. If the Ku Klux Klan wants to march in Skokie, a largely Jewish refugee neighborhood, they have a right to do so. If they intend to march and the powers that be see a real intention to roil up the public and have a confrontation, then they say no, and I think that's right. So as a bookstore, if I were a bookstore, and my employees were being threatened with their life, I would not stock Satanic Verses, because it goes beyond mere censorship and freedom of expression. It goes to the protection of an individual life.
Mm-hmm. Is there an answer to that question?
There are a lot.
How do we protect Satanic Verses and the rights of our bookstockers to live?
I haven't seen an answer. Huh. I haven't heard an answer that is satisfying for that book. The consortium of publishers that joined to publish the paperback version of Satanic Verses is an interesting approach, mm-hmm. because then it diffuses the responsibility so that Khomeini can say, okay, now kill all 50 publishers and their staffs who published the paperback version. That's a little harder to accomplish.
And the public relations route, I
mean, is not very
yes,
good.
No.
So that was actually a clever kind uh-huh. of way around it, and not a bad approach. Mm-hmm. I know that Viking has suffered terribly, mentally, physically, certainly monetarily, having to have armed guards round the clock. And it shouldn't be that way, obviously. But when it gets down to death threats, then I think you need to make different decisions.
Mentioning again Jennifer's participation in the Midnight Sun Writers Conference this year, you said also in your craft talk, you quoted Vaclav Havel in his references to the shock of freedom. He spoke of hoping that the shock of freedom would dissipate in his country so that they could get on with exercising the rights of freedom. How well do you think we handle getting over the shock of freedom and dealing with freedom in this nation?
If you want to take the 60s for a very good example of several kinds of freedoms, or at least we thought, going on at the same time, and how we responded. Walking around with dirty T-shirts and long hair and free love and all the, you know, rock and roll and all of the rest. Sex, lugs, and sex, love. What was it? I don't even remember. It's terrible.
Sex, drugs, and rock
Thank
and roll.
Thank you.
You're
that's
getting
it.
Past your time. Sex, lugs. And
lugs
and right.
or love and rock and roll. That certainly was our own little shock of freedom, I think. We were all kind of breaking out of the traditional mores and what was expected and what we were supposed to do, and experiencing the real savoring, this total open, you know, plane in front of us of possibilities. And so you abuse them. I mean, as Havel said, you know, you abuse them, you don't handle them very well. People fight, get frustrated at first, and that's what happens. And then after there is a shakedown, you learn to handle choices. I mean, freedom is really, after all, only having more choices and not being dictated to, but being allowed to make your own choices. And once you do, I think, then and you settle down and learn to accept the responsibility for making the choices, then you can come back out from chaos and have a little more control. It's a big responsibility, and one that we have sometimes succeeded in handling and sometimes not.
So how well are we handling it?
Well, if you asked a 20-year-old...
Oh, it is perceptual, isn't
it? I think it is perceptual.
Okay. So if you asked a 20-year-old...
I think they would say that we totally... In fact, I've heard this from college kids, that those of us who lived through the 60s and weren't college kids in the 60s have totally forsaken our ideals. Hmm. I would say, as I look around to the activists in college and what they're doing today, my colleagues who are in their maybe late 30s, early 40s, mid-40s, they're all pretty much doing what I'm doing. They have struck out on their own. They're working for something they believe in. They're pretty much not following the standard rules of going to work for a corporation and making your way up the ladder. And sometimes the women are quitting their jobs when they have children. Sometimes they're not. In other words, they are continuing to follow their vision for what they think makes a better world. And to me, that's what the 60s was all about to begin with.
So you see this nation, or at least that this group of people, the baby boom generation grown up, as exercising the options which freedom gives.
I think we have, and I think the Clinton-Gore ticket, not to get political about it, but to be entirely apolitical, but look at what they stand for, and look at what they're advocating, and the environmental issues, which is have unfortunately become politicized, and the, quote, family issues, and where women stand in this society, and what we're allowed or not allowed to do by the male hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And I think they kind of epitomize where the 60s generation has come from and where we have grown to.
Okay, back to books for a minute. Mm-hmm. They say it's always a bad time for poets in the publishing industry. If you were to say this is a bad time for a particular group of authors or a genre, is this a bad time for anybody in publishing?
An editor friend of mine at HarperCollins says that they refer to fiction as the F word. And it's actually not a bad time for poets. More poets are being published by more small presses.
Uh-huh.
That's a complex issue. I think it is a very bad time for fiction.
Because there's lovely fiction out there.
There is, and people are publishing a lot of it. It's what we call a crapshoot. I can print 1,500 copies of a book of poetry, spend $4,500 doing so, sell them over 3 years, and slowly earn back my $4,500 if I'm lucky. If I publish a novel by an unknown novelist like Sheena Mackay, whose books, I just bought four of her books because she's a brilliant novelist that no one in this country knows of, I have to print maybe 7,500 copies. I have to promote her in an entirely different way from poets because we expect her to sell to a broader audience. So I invest maybe $18,000 in the printing. And another,
fingers are crossed already, aren't
boy,
they?
Boy, I'm ready to stick my head in the noose. And I went and bought four of her books, so I'm going to do that four times. I have four times a chance to die out of my nine lives. And it's a much bigger investment of capital, energy, and time than a book of poetry, because it's on a much grander scale. So you can flop in a much bigger way, mm-hmm. and I have a lot more to lose.
And is nonfiction like poetry more stable?
It's a little
just
more stable.
Walks forward.
Yes, it does. There's less of a fatty feeling to it. There is a steady market for nonfiction, and fiction kind of ebbs and flows. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. We heard about a heyday in the short stories, in the short story genre. Now we hear that no one wants to look at it, and it's. It depends on the vagaries of the reading public. Fiction does. Mm-hmm. Nonfiction seems to always kind of plod along in its predictable way.
Why are American writers writing so much fiction? Are we into a major escapist push, or is that the way to express what's behind the deepest thought in the 90s?
I think we can't help it. I don't think you sit down and decide, okay, I'm going to be a nonfiction writer.
Mm.
Some of us do and can, but mostly you either are or you aren't. So it decides for you. You don't decide. I don't think there's more fiction being written now than there was 20 years ago. I just think that with the recession and with all publishers being a little, tightening the belt a little bit, being a little more conservative in their approach and not taking as many financial risks, fiction is suffering as a result of that. When we get a little more expansive and the economy gets back on track, then I think that fiction will pick up again and we'll take risks on novels that might fall flat on their face. We might even publish some short stories.
I talked to a publisher last year who said that as the biggest houses get bigger and more limited in what they will publish, then the small presses will flourish. And as the small presses decide what they will publish, then other smaller presses will crop up, and art will go again into the coffee houses and to the street corners, and will itself then create a new movement that will come up. That this is kind of an ocean that keeps refreshing itself and in ebb and flow and ebb and flow.
It is organic, and I think that's a perceptive way of describing the process. I've only been in business for 9 years, and already the first Frankfurt Book Fair I went to, a colleague asked what I was looking for, and I said, I'll know it when I see it. And this year, if a colleague were to ask me that, they don't even ask, which tells you something. Mm. They already know what I'm looking for. I have, after 9 years of publishing, pretty much defined what I'm looking for, which means I'm not looking for all of those other things, so someone else has to do that. So yes, it is organic. And the trick, I think, is to not become static, to shake yourself up as a publisher as much as writers do, mm-hmm. so that they don't write the same book over and over again. I don't want to publish the same book over and over again. And it's hard to do because I'm getting older and I know what I like and I know what I don't like. And it gets worse.
Succeeded last year, so.
Succeed this year, we hope.
So what's going to happen to the biggest of houses, those owned by Nabisco or whatever? Are they going to keep finding Stephen Kings to keep them alive in a big, big way? Or do you think there's some point where they're literally going to eat too many donuts and pop?
I think they are big enough, unless they make horrible missteps with their chairmans, like Mr. Maxwell did with some of his British publishers, they'll always survive. They're big enough that they have to make major mistakes for many years with no one stopping them before they fall, you know, before they go into bankruptcy. So they will survive. They will become more narrow, I think, in their vision, if we can call it that, and in their publishing list. And I think there will be more room for independents to grow into medium-sized independents, which will then, again, leave room on the outside for smaller independents to come in and pick up the slack.
Back to the organic process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they're big enough to weather lots of difficulties and lots of mistakes. And the fact that they are not publishing all things to all people.
I want to look at this question about size. A recent Wall Street Journal article said that there were so many niches in American music today that there was a good thing and a bad thing. And I want to ask you this question about publishing, not American music. But the good thing was that there was lots of different voices with all sorts of different kinds of music. The bad thing was that so many listeners, let's say readers, just kind of got in their niche. What you said a moment ago about publishing, I know what I like. I like reading African-American fiction from the latter half of the 20th century. And Americans aren't sampling across niche lines. True, false, irrelevant from the publisher's perspective?
It's not irrelevant. It's hard to know because we don't have very good organizations set up to track what people are reading or why, unfortunately. We're a terribly disorganized industry in that way. I mean, we do have a research study group that comes up with various pieces of information that tell us who our readers are, what they're reading, and why they're reading.
White, 44 to 52.
Right. They buy 10 books a year, and half of them are bodice rippers. I mean, we know things like that. We don't know a lot more about the reading public, so I can't answer your question. I know that the specialization of all of the aspects of life, I think, is a blessing and a curse. Obviously, it's a blessing when someone comes to fix my furnace. It's a curse when all he does is fix furnaces and can't do anything else, and when he loses his job, he's out of luck. Mm-hmm. I think that's a kind of a brash analogy for publishing books, but the same thing happens. If we learn to read are bodice rippers, then we won't be interested in poetry? Certainly not in poetry. Mm-hmm. And we may not even be interested in serious fiction, in the next Hemingway or Faulkner or Carson McCullers or Flannery O'Connor to walk in our door. We're not going to read it.
Yeah. What do you think about your readers?
My readers?
Yeah.
I think they're kings. They're gods. Anyone who would buy my book, I think, you know, my readers are the serious readers who we always talk about being somewhat recession-proof, publishing serious books of fiction, what Robert Giroux calls books as opposed to ooks. Those people who think of reading as part of their lives, I mean, they don't even think of it. It's part of their life. It's an assumption. If we have to cut back in a recession, or we lose our job and become a one-income family, or if we'd have to take a lower-paying job, then the things we cut out, those of us who are readers like this, are maybe, you know, the special little things in the grocery store, the $8 movies. We cut out other kinds of entertainment. But it would never occur to us not to continue going to the library mm-hmm. and checking out books and always having a stack on our bedside table and buying as many as we can afford to. That's my reader. So that, knock on wood, in a recession, I don't see the big upheaval that the larger publishers are feeling, even though they don't want to admit it. And I'm not laying off anyone. I'm actually adding staff when the Manhattan publishers are laying off people left and right because they're trying to cut out all the dead wood mm-hmm. and get back to the essential publishing of essential books.
Well, may your readers read on at
thank
the
you.
Library and in the bookstore. This has been Conversations. Jennifer, thank you for an hour spent with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening for the last hour to Jennifer Moyer, publisher of Moyer Bell Limited, co-owner of that company, publisher of Small Press Magazine, the magazine of independent publishing. Also poet, I will refer you once again to Jennifer's two books, both published by Spoon River Poetry Press, one in 1981, one in 1987. The first was called Frontier Woman's Scrapbook. The second, Traveling with Coyotes. Jennifer Bell, our guest today on Conversations. Thank you for your time. I hope you join me again next week.